Why haven't we developed a cure for the common cold? UW-Madison scientists have come up with a theory, and in this hour we'll discuss this recent breakthrough and what it might mean for the future treatment of colds. Plus, we'll get some advice on protecting ourselves during this cold and flu season. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, November 7th. Did you get that nasty cold this fall, the one that many of my friends say lasted several weeks and it sounded like one of those colds that settles deep into the lungs? What do you do to protect yourself from getting colds? And what do you do if you get one anyway? We will welcome your questions about preventing and treating colds, and we'll also talk about the flu, preventing and treating the flu, with our guest expert. And we will welcome your questions, your own remedies, at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He is a professor of family medicine at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. He also chairs the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He has a clinical practice at Access Community Health Center, Wingra, in Madison. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Joy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well today. And we will also talk about this new project that you are starting on influenza surveillance among school children. We'll talk about that as well. But I wanted to start with this news headline that we saw recently in the Wisconsin State Journal. No cure for common cold, but UW scientists make major breakthrough. Can you distill for us what the major breakthrough was?
Yes. Briefly, rhinoviruses are a very, very common cause of the common cold. And there are three big families of rhinoviruses designated A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the research toward treatments and development of drugs to treat the cold have been based on what we know about rhinovirus A and B. Well, research being done at the University of Wisconsin really detailed what the rhinovirus C looks like. And it is a very different virus in terms of the chemicals or proteins on the surface that we target drugs against. So because we have such a different virus out there, the drugs under development for rhinovirus A and B are not very effective for rhinovirus C. And it turns out that rhinovirus C is the one that is responsible for probably half the colds out there.
Really? So this could lead to better treatment then, especially if you have a cold that was started by rhinovirus C?
I would say yes, possibly, because the challenge out there with treating any respiratory viral disease is the element of time. And almost all the antiviral drugs we have that we can use against, for example, things like influenza, have to be started very, very early in the process for them to have any effect at all.
All right. So is this, I don't know, a major step toward finding a cure for the common cold?
Well, it's a major step in finding potential treatments out there. From this point onward, it's a very long process, so I'm not anticipating any major changes in the next several years.
Now, the rhinovirus C, that's the one that's responsible for those really nasty, deep-in-the-lungs kind of colds?
Well, it gets kind of complicated because there are so many different respiratory viruses that affect humans. Our group within family medicine and working along with colleagues from the Wisconsin Division of Public Health and our State Lab of Hygiene have been conducting surveillance over the last 5 years now, looking at causes of respiratory infections in patients coming into routine primary care practices. And we find a great abundance of a variety of viruses. So we see a lot of rhinovirus, but we also see things that people may not be as familiar with, such as coronaviruses, adenoviruses, Boca virus, human metapneumovirus, influenza, and parainfluenza viruses. So there's a lot of different players out there.
Those buggers. Well, and so is the best prevention of getting any of these viruses, is it what I've heard, just washing our hands?
That's a wonderful first step there. Across the board, the respiratory viruses are spread from person to person through fairly close contact. They're spread through what we call respiratory droplets. So a cough or a sneeze will propel very small particles within 3 to 4 feet of the individual who's coughing or sneezing. And so having distance away from people who are coughing or sneezing, or if you're coughing or sneezing, covering that cough or sneeze. And then you mentioned the hand washing. And oftentimes we encounter these respiratory secretions or droplets with our hands, and if we rub our nose or our eyes, we can really easily transmit the virus into our respiratory system. So that hand washing is very important.
Well, I mentioned that a number of my coworkers and friends have had colds already this fall. In fact, it seemed like a month ago, a lot of people were really sneezing and coughing and sniffling. Are you seeing a lot of people with colds right now?
We are, in fact. One thing I can say in terms of the general pattern we see in Wisconsin every year is that with the onset of the public school year, when kids are back in school, within about a week of that, we see the number of patients coming into our practices with colds and cold-like symptoms jumping by about 100%.
Wow.
We see a doubling at that point. And that continues through the year. But amazingly, whenever we have a prolonged vacation, for example, over the winter holiday, we see those infections or those visits drop and then start up again when kids are back in school.
And that is because?
Well, this is because that hopefully you and I are fairly discreet when we cough and sneeze, and we do a good job of covering that. However, children do a very good job of transferring snot from one to another. A little bit graphic there, but
talk about little buggers, yeah.
Yeah, but you watch what happens, and especially younger children have a lot more secretion and control that secretion a lot less well than older individuals.
I also saw a quiz on online the other day. It was some medical quiz. How much do you know about colds, I think it was. And a lot of people have this misperception that it is because you get colds around this time of year because of colder weather, and that has nothing to do with it, does it?
Well, it doesn't have anything directly. However, a number of the viruses circulate better in cooler, drier temperatures.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For example, influenza has been studied along that line and is probably more transmittable when the temperatures outside are cooler, when there's less humidity, and also during colder times, we tend to congregate more. I'll put in a special plug for about 3 weeks from today, when all of a sudden we bring all sorts of people together over the Thanksgiving turkey.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time of year, we have such an incredible exchange and interaction of people of all ages. We managed to place about 5% of the American population in airplanes and run them through airports. And this is a wonderful time for transferring viruses from one another and spreading them all over the country.
Yeah, that's what I had thought, is that it was more because we were in our homes and in enclosed spaces and closer to each other is why we spread it a little bit more easily in the winter.
Yeah, there are a lot of theories, and unfortunately they're relatively difficult to test, but they go all the way from the social crowding that we have to the role of heating systems and dry air. making the respiratory system a little bit more accessible to viruses. And then is some of the other characteristics, some of the viruses just do better with cooler temperatures.
We are talking about the cold and flu season, and we're welcoming your questions for our guest, Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He is a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you do to protect yourself from getting colds and the flu, and what do you do if you end up picking up a cold or the flu? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about how to take care of ourselves during the cold and flu season, and we are welcoming your questions for our guest expert at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, November 7th. Our guest is Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He is a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He also chairs the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He has a clinical practice at the Access Community Health Center, Wingra, in Madison. And Dr. Tempty is also just starting a new project on influenza surveillance among school children. And we'll talk a little bit about that. What is that, Dr. Tempty?
Well, we have just been fortunate enough to receive a three-year research grant from the Centers for Disease Control to look at the causes of absenteeism in children kindergarten through 12th grade. And we are working with the Oregon, Wisconsin School District, just south of Madison. And the reason that we've chosen this school district partially is because a number of the influenza experts in Wisconsin actually live within the Oregon School District, but we're also surrounded by very incredible influenza surveillance at a multitude of levels, so we're be able to easily compare what's going on within the school district with what's going on around the school district.
Mm-hmm. So what is the mission?
Well, the mission is to, number one, try and characterize specifically what's causing absenteeism in school children. So we're going to be looking at a wide variety of viruses and really focusing also on influenza, but seeing how this operates over the year in terms of how much absentee is caused, what's causing it, and also if by monitoring school children, this provides us a very early warning system for influenza. I'll take it one step further. Across Wisconsin, only about 35% of school-aged children, so those are kids from age 5 through 18, receive influenza vaccine. And this is the one group for which the vaccine works by far the best. So there's a real mismatch between a very effective preventive mechanism and its utilization in this group.
Yeah. So why do you suppose only 35% of the kids in this group are getting flu shots?
Well, I think the biggest reason out there, and I'm speaking now as a parent, is the difficulty with sports seasons, with orchestra, with musical events and so on, just finding that time to get a child to the clinic for an immunization. Mm-hmm. Where we have seen really highly successful programs have been places where there are school-based immunization programs, and oftentimes you'll see coverage rates in the range of 70 to 80% there.
Mm-hmm. Some parents are leery about immunizations, though, aren't they? And what can you tell parents who might have some concerns that the flu immunization is somehow risky?
Well, I can start out by saying that in my role with the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, I get to see a lot of the information, the data, and the studies out there looking at safety. And I can just attest to the incredibly high safety of vaccines in general. That being said, most people don't realize that there are ongoing mechanisms running behind the scenes all the time looking at vaccine safety, testing hypotheses about the role of immunization and influenza vaccine in triggering off various rare adverse events and side effects. And this is going on all the time. And so we don't just put a vaccine out there and say, you know, this is safe, but we're constantly monitoring that safety, looking for any signals. And when something does occur, the system is very reactive to that.
Yeah, I did get a flu shot a couple of months ago, and my husband did too. My husband has a little bit of asthma, and I also do it because I don't want to get the flu and make things even worse for him. So, but a lot of people still think that getting a flu shot causes them to get the flu, and they'll complain about muscle aches and flu-like symptoms the very next day. Is there a connection?
Well, there certainly can be a connection between the muscle aches, feeling feverish, and so on after virtually any immunization, because what we're doing is we're stimulating our immune system. Some people will have a stronger reaction, and that can be interpreted as, I'm coming down with the flu. The difference between that type of response and an actual infection is whether or not you have virus invading your cells, taking over your cells, using the cells biochemical mechanisms to make copies of themselves and then spread beyond. So compared to a case of influenza, where people are typically sick for 3 to 10 days, what we see after an immunization in a small percentage of people is just perhaps some achiness, some tiredness, and so on that might last a day or two. But we typically mm-hmm. don't see the flu. This is a killed virus product, just parts of virus in the injectable kind, and that just doesn't have the possibility of triggering off an influenza infection. The live virus vaccines that we typically use for children and all the way, you know, from age 2 all the way up through age 40 are viruses that are attenuated, meaning that they're weakened, and also they're adapted to replicate or to reproduce in cold environments such as exist in your nose but not in your lungs. And so these vaccines tend to cause just very, very mild nasal symptoms for most recipients.
We haven't seen a confirmed case of the flu yet this season, or have we?
Oh, we have.
Oh,
and
okay.
In the wake of the pandemic in 2009, 2010, when we really turned up the surveillance a great deal, what we're finding is influenza viruses can be detected virtually every month of the year in Wisconsin. The big difference is during the late spring, summer, and early fall, they are quite rare. And about this time of year, we start seeing more and more activity. So in Wisconsin so far, I think we have had less than 10 detections that are confirmed. And these have predominantly been influenza A viruses and distributed between two different families there.
Well, we have callers and emailers. Let me get at least one caller on before our news break. Diane in Madison, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I've heard from several people that you have, or some people have, in them the influenza or cold virus, and it's called an incubation period before they actually break out with the flu or the cold. Is that true? If you're around somebody and they've already got the virus and then they break out and there's a two-week incubation period.
Yeah, we just have a minute before news, Dr. Tim.
And I can answer that very quickly. For influenza viruses, it tends to be about 1 to 2 days for incubation period from the time that you encounter the virus until you start becoming ill. It's possible to spread influenza that in those early times, but the most contagious people are during day number 2 and number 3 when you have a lot of copies of virus in your respiratory secretions. And that also is the time that you typically feel the worst with influenza. People will stop shedding virus after 5 to 6 days, but it's very true that you incubate this for a little bit.
Is it much different for colds?
Well, some of the viruses might be more like 3 to 8 days of incubation period, mm-hmm. but we'd rarely get more than about 10 days for incubation. But most are right in that range of 1 to 3 days.
All right. We will check news from NPR and from Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll be back talking more about colds and flu. This is the Ideas Network. What are the best practices for preventing colds and the flu? How effective are cold remedies and flu shots and treatments? What's new on the horizon? We are talking about all these things during this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Thursday, November 7th, and we're welcoming your questions and your own remedies. What do you do to prevent or treat colds and the flu? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Jonathan Temte, a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He also chairs the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He has a clinical practice at Access Community Health Center, Wingra, in Madison. Dr. Temte is also just starting a new project on influenza surveillance among school children. And we have another caller waiting. Dawn in Milwaukee is next. Hello, Dawn.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your question or remedy?
Well, I have a question in terms of my daughter's in college, and one of her logic teachers is telling her the echinacea, Tavis D, all the different preventers don't work. Is that true?
Well, outside of immunizations for the respiratory viruses, there really isn't much in terms of prevention, in terms of medications you can take up front to prevent coming down with a cold or the flu. The only exception that is out there and available is a medication, actually two medications that are licensed for prophylaxis or prevention of influenza for people who are unable to get influenza vaccine or are at high risk and are exposed.
And those are the medicines that you can, if you think you have come down with the flu, that if you take those medicines, it will at least relieve the severity of it?
That's true. The two medications, one is an oral pill or suspension called oseltamivir. The trade name is Tamiflu. The other is an inhaled powder called zanamivir, or the trade name Relenza. And these can be effective, but are only effective if used very, very early in the course of an influenza infection. And by early, we know that within hours of the first onset, they work pretty well, but you get more than a day and a half to 2 days, and they're largely ineffective.
What about the over-the-counter zinc-based things that you can take if you want to lessen the symptoms of a cold?
Well, a number of the over-the-counter products have what I would call marginal effectiveness or benefit. That what we see is benefit measured probably in hours of symptom relief measured over a course of several days. So there isn't anything out there that really has very strong efficacy out there for colds or flu.
Yeah. Well, William emails, I am HIV positive, and I also have a compromised immune system. I currently take a multivitamin and a daily 500 milligram vitamin C booster. I hardly ever get ill with this regimen. What about multivitamins and vitamin C?
Well, in general, people who have good nutrition, who are well-rested, who are not overly stressed, will tend to have fewer infections. So my compliments to William for following those important things for a healthy lifestyle. But he also brings up a very, very important point. When we talked about influenza immunization, and it's not only ourselves that we're protecting, but we're protecting those people out there who may be vaccinated but may not have a very good response to the vaccine because of immunodeficiencies and things like that. So when we're immunized, and as a healthcare provider, it's very important for me to receive my vaccine. But it's not only myself I'm protecting, but I'm also protecting those patients that I see on a daily basis and people who are at much higher risk for the outcomes of influenza.
Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence that vitamin C helps in any way?
Again, the evidence out there, when you look at well-done randomized controlled trials, we see virtually no effect or just a slight, but nothing very significant.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Doctor, if there's anything different about the strength of our immune systems in colder weather. Does that make a difference?
Well, again, it's really hard to measure, and there aren't a lot of good studies looking at how the immune system responds to differences in weather. There was, for a time, a theory out there that vitamin D levels made people more or less prone to respiratory infections. And as we all know, vitamin D is made by our skin through exposure to sunlight. But those studies have largely fallen aside as well. So in terms of seasonality of immune response, we don't see a whole lot of that going on either.
Yeah. What's the difference? What's going on when someone has, I don't know, maybe even it is somebody has a cold three times during a winter or multiple colds during the year and somebody else doesn't have any? What is it? Is it just a matter of the immune system?
Well, I think it's a matter of immune system. It's a matter of exposure. In general, when we look at children in the first 2 years of life, we're looking at somewhere about six colds or six respiratory infections on average per year. As we get older, we tend to have fewer. However, in every study I've ever seen looking at community patterns, we see something interesting going on. So a lot of respiratory infections in younger children up through the school years, it drops down. There's a second peak in the childbearing ages, especially in women, and then it tapers off as we get older. But a lot of this is exposure. Is exposure children to other children in school, daycare, and other settings. And then there's exposure parents to children. And so people who are coming down with multiple infections, I oftentimes think, you know, what is the exposure going on? Are they exposed to children? Are they exposed to other individuals who are carrying the viruses?
Yeah. Is there a different virus that is going on if you have a cold versus bronchitis? Sometimes, At one point, I had what I thought was a typical cold, and eventually it was diagnosed as being bronchitis, and I had to have an antibiotic then when an antibiotic is not called for if it's just a cold.
Well, this comes in the whole area of how we as physicians and other healthcare providers name things. And bronchitis is nothing more than inflammation in the larger tubes going down into your lungs called the bronchi. And virtually any respiratory virus, when it goes into the chest, causes a bronchitis. Bronchitis is notorious for being one of the largest causes of inappropriate use of antibiotics in this country. And we see anywhere from 60 to 90% of cases of quote-unquote bronchitis receiving antibiotic, when in fact very few cases of bronchitis really require an antibiotic for improvement. That's a segue for me just to mention that when it has been looked at carefully in large studies, the average length of a cough after a respiratory virus is 17 days. So that something persists for 2 to 3 weeks is not uncommon and actually is expected.
Well, that's too long. Just kidding.
Well, it is. And I had previously mentioned that little kids might have 4 to 6 respiratory infections a year. And oftentimes at that age, that cough and runny nose can go on for 4 to 6 weeks. So in the first 2 years of life in Wisconsin, oftentimes we'll see kids with runny noses for half of their life.
Wow. Well, we are talking about the cold and flu season and how to take care of ourselves during the cold and flu season, what we can do to prevent and treat colds and flu. And we're welcoming your questions for our guest doctor, Dr. Jonathan Temte. He is a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He also has a clinical practice at Access Community Health Center, Wingra, in Madison. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you do to prevent colds or the flu or to treat them? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about preventing and treating colds and the flu. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 11 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Thursday, November 7th. Talking with Dr. Jonathan Temte, and our next caller is Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I read a small article in the newspaper about 6 weeks ago about the fact that the federal government was going to be making available a high-dose flu shot for people, elderly people, and I am certainly elderly. So I called Walgreens. They told me that they had the vaccine on hand and made all the arrangements for me to come in the next day and get it. But when I went there the next day, I got the usual dose of flu shot. So I'm a little confused about the fact that they're telling me that there is no titer test available to find out, first of all, if I got any adequate protection at all, and second of all, if I got a lower dose of protection, or I should say a lower immunological response of protection than I would have gotten from the high dose. Therefore, is it really safe for me? They have offered to give me another dose of vaccine to make up for the fact that I didn't get the high dose. But if the high dose is supposed to have a concentration 4 times greater than the usual dose, I'm wondering what it is, what more I can ask to get to atone for that fact and to give me then the immunological response that I would have gotten had I gotten the high-dose vaccine.
Thank you very much, Nancy. First of all, there is a high-dose vaccine, Dr. Temte?
Yeah, absolutely, and what a timely question. So I thank Nancy for this. There is a high-dose influenza vaccine, and as Nancy mentioned, very correctly, it has 4 times the amount of antigen or the immune response chemical in it that our bodies take to form antibodies for protection. When we look at this particular vaccine, it does indeed produce higher antibody levels in people receiving the vaccine. And this is true not only for your typical person over the age of 65, but a recent study looked at what we call frail elderly, individuals who have multiple medical problems living in nursing homes, and in fact, their antibody levels are higher as well.
Should Nancy get a second flu shot since she just got a regular flu shot the first time?
Well, let me take it a step further. So just 2 weeks ago, this was discussed in Atlanta when we met for one of our three per year Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices meetings at the Centers for Disease Control. And we finally saw the results of a very large study done looking at the high-dose influenza vaccine. And what I can tell you is this vaccine, in relative terms, reduces influenza infection in the recipients by about 25% compared to the regular dose influenza vaccine. When we look at what the effect is in terms of an absolute scale, what it means is about 4 individuals per 1,000 who receive the high-dose vaccine compared to the regular dose, about 4 per 1,000 fewer end up with influenza. As it turns out, the wonderful news is older individuals tend to get influenza at pretty low levels when they're immunized with either vaccine. So the benefit you get from the high dose is not as much as we were hoping for, but there is a difference. Now, the second part of the question deals with should Nancy receive a second vaccine? And this is an area that we know very little about. There are no good studies out there looking at whether revaccination is a benefit or if revaccination actually causes some immunologic blocking or blunting where the response is actually lower than it would be with a single. So our current recommendation for the nation is that people receive one influenza vaccine, typically September through December, but sometimes with the flu season going on longer, we'll keep on immunizing until there isn't flu out there. So right now the advice would be to receive one vaccine and go from there.
Thank you, Nancy, for the call. Dennis in Sister Bay has a related question. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I have a concern about its availability. I checked on that very fact out of state and also in Wisconsin, and I'm repeatedly told, well, we don't have it.
Well, one of the problems out there, Dennis, is with any new vaccine or a vaccine with a higher antigen content, it's a costlier vaccine. And oftentimes, healthcare systems will not purchase that higher cost vaccine. So that's one of the problems. Also, as a new vaccine, there's just many fewer doses available across the country than other vaccines. For this current influenza season, we're looking at somewhere around 130 million doses of vaccine for influenza available to the United States. And it's just a very small fraction of that amount, which is in the high-dose form.
Thank you, Dennis. Susan emails, after getting a flu vaccine, how soon are you protected and how long does it last? And I might add, how effective is it?
Three very good questions. Usually within 2 weeks after receiving vaccine, you are as protected as you're going to be. Typically for a healthy adult and a healthy child, we look at the immunologic protection going on for at least 7 months after receipt. So people who are receiving vaccine in September, October, November are protected through the year. And then finally, how effective is that vaccine? The vaccines, you know, it depends on the year and the strains out there. And we have seen roughly about overall 60% effective, which means that it reduces your likelihood of contracting influenza when exposed by about 60%. We would love to see it at 100%, but unfortunately, we're not there. We would love to see an influenza vaccine that you give once every 5 or 10 years, but the science hasn't gotten that far as of yet.
Here's an email from Seth. Hand sanitizers are known to kill bacteria, not viruses. Are we relying too much on hand sanitizers during the cold season?
Well, I think the important point here is that a common mechanism of transmission of viruses in general, and the respiratory viruses, will be the hand-to-nose or hand-to-eye. So paying attention to that, and use of hand sanitizer can be a reminder. Soap and water works well also. And then, you know, just the covering of the cough and sneeze. Some of the viruses do succumb to the alcohol-based hand sanitizers, so I do encourage the use therein. Unfortunately, some of the viruses out there, and one of the ones that we did not talk about here is called respiratory syncytial virus, and this is notorious for causing big-time problems in infants. But this is a virus that can persist on a surface for 8 or 10 hours. And it makes it very susceptible for easy transmission through inanimate objects.
Okay. Well, you know, we're just about out of time. I have, in our final minute, any final words of advice for people to prevent and cope with the cold and flu season?
Well, the one prevention we have out there is influenza vaccine. So I recommend this for everyone age 6 months through senescence. Number one. Number two, good hand washing and good cough and sneeze hygiene. So covering that cough, covering that sneeze. Number three, if you are concerned, you want to be avoiding those areas with a lot of crowding, especially if there are coughing and sneezing people around. If you can't do that, a simple surgical mask, a paper mask over your nose and mouth, is very effective in prevention of contracting one of the respiratory viruses. Well, and then finally, if you do come down and you want treatment, that has to be done very, very quickly for influenza.
We'll leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you very much. Have a wonderful day, John. Yeah,
and be well. Dr. Jonathan Temte is a professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He chairs the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and also has a clinical practice at the Access Community Health Center, WINGRA, in Madison. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Christy Taylor for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. This is the Ideas Network.